Welcome to the Corporate Venturing Insider Series, where I interview top practitioners in the CVC world and learn with you the best practices and golden nuggets that they have accumulated over their career. In this episode, we will be learning from David Lee, head of Samsung Next. David, could you take a few minutes to share your story and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. You know, my career has had many twists and turns. I have a master's degree in electrical engineering. I thought I wanted to be a professor. Then I went to law school. I was an awful attorney, probably left a wake of litigation behind me, and eventually ended up at Google around 2003. And eventually I moved over to business development. And fast forward, I was able to get a career or start a career in venture capital with Baseline Ventures, Steve Anderson, and ultimately Ron Conway at SV Angel. And I managed SV Angel from 2007 or 8 until 2015. After that, I took some time off, thought about what I wanted to do, co-founded a fund around digital health and infrastructure. And at that point in my life, around 2019, 2020, I thought I was really done with the professional sphere and thought I just wanted to angel invest, advise startups. And this opportunity came up at Samsung. And it's really the only job that I would ever take. I'm a Korean American. I don't speak Korean, but there is something about when Samsung calls, it's like if Broadway calls, if you're an actor or actress. This was around 2020. I've been at Samsung now for about 3.5 years. I did think being at a large company or a company generally was a really interesting perspective for this part of the cycle. It was an interesting place just to sit and to understand and to learn. And so it's been a circuitous journey. Our group at Samsung Next, we take an approach very similar to SV Angel in that we really focus on surface area, on learning, on connecting dots, helping to bring value back to Samsung. But we also do some corporate strategy work, but that's the bread and butter is really investing in companies and trying to bring value back to Samsung.
Thank you. So before we go into what you do at Samsung Next, I want to just maybe give you a chance to pick up on what you think is most valuable background making you an investor. Was it your engineering background? Was it your time as a lawyer?
It's a great question. I believe the best training or the best experience that prepared me to be an investor was law school, actually, or being a lawyer. And when you are a professional service provider, you really understand what it takes to be client-centric and service-oriented. And there's this notion, or there was this book called The Trusted Advisor, which I read when I first started my law career. And that's what I really aspire to. And I think for venture capital, for investing, I think having that mindset of serving the entrepreneur, everybody says they can do it, but unless you've gotten a phone call at Friday night when you're about to go to sleep and the client calls you and says, get on the plane, you're going to go do due diligence in the middle of America on this one deal, and you just have to grin, bear it, and enjoy it. So I think there's that experience. There's also being an attorney. I don't think it's a coincidence that a lot of the great investors have law degrees. A lot of really great business people in technology have law degrees. And I think when it comes to law as opposed to business, you're really forced to think bottoms up, right? Mm-hmm. First thing you do in law is you look at the facts, right? And so starting with the facts, law is very logical. If you look at a really well-written, complex corporate contract, it has the same structure as old school computer code. And I think understanding how engineers, product people think, that was in a way very helpful, being a lawyer and having that training, and also engineering as well, right? Venture capital is really a career by accident. And so I think if you can have different experiences, whether it's as an undergraduate, graduate, earlier in your career, and I think the number one thing is you just have to love the subject matter.
I have so much to unpack. And for the audience who know you, they know you've been an amazing early stage fund with many secular companies. Maybe we'll speak about that. But I want to touch on client-centric because I think that's core to who you are and seeing the entrepreneurs as a client. Maybe you can talk a little bit about how you see the entrepreneurs, because last time we met, you actually talked a lot about it, all about the entrepreneurs.
I don't know what shareholder letter it was, but Jeff Bezos talked earlier in his time at Amazon about the focus on the customer. And he wrote to his shareholders, like, listen, I'm always going to focus on the customer. And the focus on the customer will always supersede that of the interests of the shareholders. And it was a little bit of a subversive, controversial statement, because that was a time when maximizing shareholder value was really the prevailing principle for what your role was as a CEO. Your role as a CEO, as an allocator of capital and resources, is to maximize shareholder value. And what Bezos said in one of his shareholders was, listen, I'm going to focus on the customer. And ultimately, if I do that, the shareholder value will take care of itself. And if you really focus on serving the entrepreneur, not in a touchy-feely way, and by touchy-feely, there are different ways of serving an entrepreneur in the same way that there are different ways of being a parent, or there are different ways of helping a child develop. Everybody plays a different role. You have parents, maybe you have grandparents, you have aunts and uncles. They all have different relationships with the entrepreneur, right? And so my career was primarily an early stage. I didn't take board seats. And so what I really tried to do and emulate from some of the people that I work with is just be that trusted advisor for founders when they hit those really tough spots. And so serving founders can mean a lot of different things. It can be being the first person who responds to an investor update with requests. It can be giving tough love. And sometimes that's the most valuable thing. If you think about, I'm a parent of two children, 15 and 10, and the way I serve them is not by being raw, touchy-feely and saying everything's more Pollyannish, but it's helping them prepare to be an adult. And similarly, I think that's the posture you want to take as an investor. I think the board member assumes the role more of a parent of a 10-year-old kid, and the angel investor is the parent of a child from 0 to 10. The role is just very different. And then the late stage are like the grandpa, they're older and it's just don't do anything stupid. But I think if you just focus on the entrepreneur, that's where it starts paying dividends. And that's where you create a positive feedback loop, because this is a reputation business. Like these founders, they talk Korean grandmas, you know what I mean? They talk amongst themselves, they share knowledge, they share what they think about other people. And you really want to, aside from doing the right thing, develop a strong reputation for somebody who stands by and supports founders on their journey.
And I think it touched on the words you use, trusted advisor. It's not just being an advisor. It's your trusted. You may be the first call, the first text, need your advice and know you're going to have their interest at heart.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And that's just something you earned, right? There's no other way. You don't get it just because you're the largest investor or you're the first investor. It's just something you have to earn, and it takes a lot of time. And when you have that relationship, then it's really meaningful.
I'm going to ask you something uncomfortable, which is try not to be humble. But can you pick one example where you were a very early investor and you helped the company grow with your advice? And what was it that could be useful for the audience to understand they should do?
I'm not being humble here. And I think every good investor, in my view, will share this sentiment. For the really great companies, you don't really do a lot, right? You would be smart just to get out of the way and help them when they ask. And this goes back to the service mentality. If they ask me, hey, can somebody get an introduction? I need some 409A help and I need a consultant. I want to be the first one to do that. You know, it's something that somebody fresh out of college could do. And here I am with 20 years of work experience. And you have to have the humility to do that, because whether or not you're a founder, you're an investor, you're young or you're old, I think we all respond subconsciously to certain behaviors. And when it comes to any service provider, if you show up to your doctor and they're always 10 to 15 minutes late. It always shows up longer. The appointment is longer than you think. You're like, yeah, the doctor's fine. But I have one doctor. He is the best in LA. If the appointment's at 12, it starts at 12. And he's completely present. And you just realize, aha, that's what it takes, right? But even then, I would say that you can augment and you can amplify, but you can never be, an investor will never be a causal reason why a company is the breakout company. My favorite company, probably it's lesser known, is a company called Benchling. And Saji was a founder who, they talk about how Kobe Bryant or David Beckham at Friday night, they'd be playing football or shooting hoops while all the other kids are partying. It's a gym rat. And Saji was really a lab rat. Like, he really enjoyed biology and he was a coder. He was at MIT and he built something for himself in terms of just making the whole research process, the whole development process a little bit more delightful using software. And in that case, I didn't do anything. It's not like I understood the market, but I just tried to meet him and be there. And so I think the one thing I think about that company, and now it's a multi-billion dollar company. It's become the GitHub for biotech. And I'm happy where it's just, I was there when nobody else was.
And we are lucky to be part of that journey.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So let's talk about great entrepreneurs, because you've picked so many that then built unicorns. What would be the moment for you where you're like, okay, that's a great entrepreneur? Is it grit? Is it smartness? What is it for you?
First of all, I was very lucky to have a lot of success in my career. I call myself a turtle on top of a post. I started my career 2008 and then ended 2015. It was the fastest and most meaningful period of a technology adoption in US history, with everybody getting a smartphone. You had cloud computing, you had zero interest rates. So it was hard not to be successful. And I was also part of a team and we were able to meet a lot of the great entrepreneurs. And to answer your question, it's just so hard. It's actually the part of the job that I love the most, which is when you meet a founder, and I look for an ability to explain something very simply and very enthusiastically. So there's this one founder, Jason Tan from Sift Science. It was fraud detection for certain types of payments, but he made it interesting. And he had this weird charisma and he could explain the problem that he had, the problem that he was solving, and why that was interesting. But I think those two traits, it's not just being able to do it simply, because that shows domain expertise. You also have to do it enthusiastically and energetically, because that speaks to your ability to attract people to join you. So if I see those two things, then I'm leaning forward. And the most important thing is, I think there's just no substitute for seeing thousands of startups at a similar stage, right? Because I think what a lot of people do is, you think about like Jack Dorsey, Mark Zuckerberg, Patrick Collison, and you see them today and they're titans. They're so well-spoken, they're articulate, they're great strategists, great allocators of capital. But when you met them when they first started, they were just like any other founder, right? So when you meet a founder, you can't compare them to Zuckerberg of today. You have to have some game film in your head where you can compare him or her to Zuckerberg or any great founder at 23.
Like reverse engineer in a way.
Exactly. And one of my favorite pastimes is the NFL draft here in the US, where the NFL is probably the most powerful sports league in the world. And they get it wrong 50% of the time, right? That's the part that I really enjoy.
It's a golden nugget. And you could argue an entrepreneur is always pitching, always selling. And if you can explain simply and get the audience to want whatever you're selling or pitching. So let me actually double click on the NFL analogy. But now what you already implied, but I think it's a really good way, which is they spend so much time due diligencing the potential player.
Right.
What makes a great investor?
I think there are two things. The first is you have to be insanely curious. You just have to be voracious in your curiosity. And there are some investors who are voraciously curious about people and situations and founders. There are some people that are really curious about technology and where the world is going. And then the second, and I think this may not be as popular of an answer, you just have to be really competitive. But regardless of the competition level, I think you just have to have this drive that is somewhat of an obsession. Whatever it is, drive, competitiveness, you have to be as competitive, as driven as the best founder.
Now, you talked about the fact it's a career by accident. So tell me about the accident that got you into venture capital, but more importantly, how did you know that was for you?
My dad was the first founder I knew. He started a company, PhD in engineering. He invented the first fully automated fortune cookie machine. And he was always telling me, you got to build. Don't chase money. Don't push paper. Build something. And I think there was a part of me, and just to share it personally, where I just knew I wasn't that person. Like, I don't like building stuff. I was probably more of the banker lawyer type. But obviously, he's my dad. He's close to him. And so I always wanted to be the person behind the person, the builder. And that's part of the reason why I went to law school. At the 90s at the time, the people behind the creatives, the people behind the talent, were generally had law degrees. And so I always wanted to be the person behind the builder. And it was a career by accident because I wasn't looking for it, but I did have this picture in my mind of where I wanted to be in 5 or 10 years and where I wanted to be. I didn't know what job it was, but I knew it was helping the builders, which are really the talent. They're the actors and actresses. In the 80s, those were the people that were really lionized. And today, thankfully, it's the people who are actually building stuff.
It really resonates. So at TDK Ventures, we call the entrepreneurs the impact scalers, because their base mission is to bring positive impact to the world and to scale it.
Yeah.
And we'd like to think that venture capital done well is the impact scalers behind the impact scalers, or impact scaler squared.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Samsung next. So this is now corporate venturing. You talked about secular trends taking intensive capital, clearly with a lot of risk and the rewards, not just financial, but also contribution to society. Talk to me about your choice to join Samsung Next, and what are you doing?
Yeah, I mentioned earlier, I think for me personally, there's no other job in the world that I would take. And I honestly, I don't know if I would have gone to any other company at this point in my career. I looked at, this was about 3 or 4 years ago, and I thought, where we are right now, we don't register as highly as I'd like us to when it comes to the hearts and minds of founders. So let's get back into the hearts and minds of founders. Let's insert ourselves in the network, get ourselves in the flow of information and knowledge, and then share some of that, synthesize some of that, and bring it back to Samsung. And with the founders, for me, what I've learned is founders give me a good sense of timing. So if you see 2 or 3 companies in, let's say, robotics 10 years ago, right? You just keep that in the back of your mind. Why are these people who can do anything in the world and they're so smart, but they're doing robotics? Something must have changed for this to be an interesting area to pursue from a commercial standpoint. Now, often what will happen is you see those 2 or 3, but they're still a little bit early. If you do your job, you can think about, you're never going to time it perfectly, but you can say, okay, why didn't that work? And so for me, that's what we hope to do with Samsung Next.
If I take some of the golden nuggets you just mentioned, I think your early stage investments allows you to get insights as early as possible about like an emerging trend, but also build intimacy with these entrepreneurs who are building the future. So then when the trend does validate, you could say, hey, do you want to meet these entrepreneurs? They've been working for it for, I don't know, 5, 8 years. They know what they're doing. We could fast track our learnings.
That's exactly it. I think there are two areas, and AI is a fascinating area because what's really interesting is that in a very short period, it has become a top-down and bottoms-up endeavor. And what do I mean by that? If you look at least my experience in working with a lot of enterprise companies, a lot of it is bottoms-up. You start with the developers, you start with the employees. It could be Dropbox, it could be Box, it could be Slack, it could be GitHub. And then all of a sudden, the coders are like pounding the table, like, we need to have this. And CIO eventually does a purchase order. And they don't really think about the trend. Whereas AI, I think you have the highest decision makers at every big company saying, what should we be doing about AI? But it's also AI as a bottoms up, right? And the bottoms up, I think, is really helpful to go early. Because the bottoms up takes longer, right?
So I want to talk also about patient capital. Part of what you bring with Samsung behind is patient capital, where it's still very early. And everyone knows it takes 10 years to have an overnight success. And can you speak to the value of patient capital? And sometimes I feel like VCs are meant to be patient capital, but sometimes very impatient. Corporate VCs have the opportunity to be a bit more patient.
Yeah. I would love your take on this, Ben. I've been working corporate venture for 4 years. My view of corporate venture capital is that fuzzy. It tries to do too many things. And I like to think of, if we were to make a strategic investment, your sort of classic corporate venture capital investment, in my view, it has to have a clear, attainable result. You'll be able to say, this was a success. It returned 25x, right? Or this was okay, it was 10x. But there is clear strategic value there, where anything capital intensive, it could be AI, it could be bio, it could be anything. I think strategic investments start to make a little bit more sense because the strategics have resources that other companies don't, other firms don't, and they can be more patient. What's the point of making a $10 million investment when you can't clearly articulate how will this be a success? Like, numerically, how is this a success?
No, I really like the way you've described it. I like the word fuzzy because I think many corporate VCs have many whys or many goals.
Yes.
And I think there is huge value in absolute clarity on your why. How you do it could be many ways. So if I talk about TDK Ventures, our why is simple. It's about helping TDK know where to go and where not to go, build first-to-market solution. That's our why. How we do it is we want to be strategic and financial, and then we can have many tactics underneath. But I think your point about fuzziness, I think, is when the goal is not absolutely clear for everyone. But when it's clear, there's huge value because then you can communicate that goal to the entrepreneur, and there's no surprise to what you will bring and what you will not bring.
Exactly. And for me, the optimal approach is you take a barbell approach. You invest in a lot of companies with smaller checks to learn, develop relationships, synthesize information, make corporate smarter. And then on the other side, it is, we are going to invest whatever it takes to obtain this clear, attainable result, because it has this X level of importance. And anything in between, it's not an optimal allocation of a company's capital.
And you're talking about effectiveness.
Yes, exactly. And the one thing I'll say as well, a sign of a good technology CEO is somebody who's always interested in understanding, what are the early startups building today? And so you just do a showcase for them. You bring in 20 and it's a dog and pony show for your CEO. I remember taking our CEO to Y Combinator. He was really energized. And it's hard to do that when you don't have a relationship with the founder. You can't just come in and say, hey, can you present to our CEO? Little things like that start to add up. And then I would also add, in many ways, we're like a strategic planning group, and we're going to make investments. And over a 10-year period, we're going to pay back all of our operating expenses and then also generate some profit. Can you say that about any other strategic planning group or corporate strategy group, less clear. So yeah.
My last question for you, Samsung Next, what's next? So tell us, especially for the entrepreneurs now, but potential co-investors who are listening in the audience, what it is you're excited about the next 12 and 18 months so they know to reach out to you?
Yeah, you know, I think it's there are three areas that we think about a lot, but our footprint is so vast that if you're building something that, where physics is a constraint, it's probably relevant to us.
Can you elaborate?
Yeah, probably a better way of putting it is AI, robotics, and digital health. Okay. And AI and digital health, I think, is pretty clear what the opportunity is. AI as well. Can you reimagine some of these devices, whether it's a phone, PC, TV, tablet, where it's quote unquote AI first? Digital health, I mentioned the opportunity there. And robotics is an area of emerging interest because it's this combination of hardware and software that really can create delightful experiences, both commercially and also in the home. And so there's a lot of talk of humanoid. We've invested in Figure 1X and some others. And that it's a really fascinating area because there's a question as to whether or not everything happening in generative AI and software is an accelerant. It certainly is, but how much of an accelerant is it to all the work that's being done in robotics? And it's one of the things, one of this very simple but not easy ideas that we try to adhere to as well, which is just follow the founders. And when you see really smart founders working in an area, that's an aha moment of, oh, this could be interesting. And what I've learned over my career as well is that works maybe one time out of 10, right? But that one time usually really hits.
All right. This was an amazing interview, David. You've been as good as last time. So thank you so much for all the golden nuggets and the insight you've shared.
Thanks, Nicholas.